Welcome to the afternoon session. I'm going to continue on the same theme we were just working on before. And one of the main points that I've been trying to make so far is that often people don't understand how to establish mindfulness. And very often what happens, because they don't really know why, is that very often people use willpower to try to hold the mind in the present moment. And that often doesn't work because the mind rebels, the mind becomes restless, the mind becomes slothful because it becomes tired of all the willpower you use. So because of that, there actually is a Dhamma way of establishing mindfulness. And the Dhamma way of establishing mindfulness is not willpower, but it always is the overcoming of the unwholesome states of mind. When you overcome the unwholesome states of mind, mindfulness happens. So because of that, and this has been kind of the main theme of the previous one, is to actually understand how mindfulness comes about naturally by itself without having to use willpower to establish it. And this is the theme of the next discourse here. This is Majjhima 20. In English, it has been translated as the removal of distracting thoughts. Actually, what the Pali says is just the removal of thoughts or the quietening of thoughts. Is what the Pali actually reads. It doesn't say anything about distracting. And the type of thoughts that is meant in the sutta are the unwholesome thoughts. So this is about how to achieve this. We've already seen quite a bit about how to achieve it already, but this goes into more detail about how to do that. So this is how it goes. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There he addressed the monks thus, "Monks, Venerable Sir," they replied, and the Buddha said this, "Monks, when a monk is pursuing the higher mind, from time to time he should give attention to five signs." You can say five things here to make it easy to understand. To five things. What are these five? So this introduction here, when it says that the monk is pursuing the higher mind, the Pali term is the adi-citta. And if you know a bit of Pali, you know citta is like mind. And adi here has a sense of higher. In other words, the nobler mind, if you like, the purer mind. And the adi-citta in the suttas usually is a reference to the deep stages of samadhi known as the four jhanas. These are what really constitutes the higher mind. But of course, the closer you are to that, the higher you can argue the mind is. So, in other words, if you want to attain samadhi, if you want to attain jhana, this is what you got to do, basically. So this is the overcoming of negative thoughts to enable you to attain jhana, deep states of samadhi. This is what this sutta is about. So, the first method coming up, number one. Here, monks, when a monk is giving attention to some sign, and owing to that sign, there arises in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, with delusion, he should give attention to some other sign, connected with what is wholesome. When he gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and unified, concentrated. Just as a skilled carpenter or his apprentice might knock out, remove, and extract a coarse peg by means of a fine one, so too, and the whole thing is repeated, when a bhikkhu gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and unified, concentrated. So that is the first method there. And first of all, this paragraph, I should maybe explain that very often you might be maybe surprised if you are new to the suttas. The suttas always talks about a bhikkhu. The Buddha is always talking to a bhikkhu. And the reason for that is because most of the discourses were obviously spoken to his monk disciples. And not only that, but it was the monk disciples who would normally remember the discourses. So the discourses that we have left from the Buddha are the ones that were spoken to the monk disciples, because the monk disciples were the ones that learned them and memorized those discourses. So that is the reason why so many of these things are spoken to the monks. It doesn't mean that these are only relevant to the monks, just as relevant to the nuns. They're relevant to lay people as well. It just really depends on how committed you are to practicing the Buddhist path, how relevant they are. And then it says, a bhikkhu is giving attention to some sign. Now this word sign, the Pali word is nimitta. And you may have heard this word nimitta many times. It's often used as the samadhi nimitta, the nimitta of concentration. And the samadhi nimitta often is used in the present day as a kind of light that you get in the mind when the mind becomes very powerfully unified. And that's usually what is called the samadhi nimitta. In the suttas, it doesn't mean that. In the word of the Buddha, the word nimitta basically means object. It can also mean sign. Sign in the sense of a particular aspect of an object. For example, you can look at an object, any object. You can see either the beautiful in that object or the non-beautiful, the ugly aspect of that object. So if you see the beautiful, you're seeing the beautiful sign. If you're seeing the ugly, you're seeing the ugly sign. And so sign nimitta, in that sense, is like a characteristic or a feature. But generally, the word simply means object. That's what it means in the suttas. So if you read it understanding this to mean object, it becomes much more easy to understand. When a bhikkhu is giving attention to some object, and owing to that object, in other words, whatever you are thinking about, whatever you have in your mind, that is the object, and due to that, there arises in him evil, it says here. I think bad is a much better translation. Bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate and delusion. So whether these negative things arise depends on the object you're looking at, and not only the object, but how you are looking at that object. It's very much of how the way we see the world is connected with how we look at the world. Not just the world as it is, but how we look at it. And it is the how that determines whether you have a negative state of mind or you have a positive state of mind. It's very important. So object and sign here are kind of interrelated. And the kind of things that arise here are, says here, desire, hate, and delusion. Desire, raga, hate, dosa and delusion, moha. These are the raga, dosa, moha, a very standard set to find in the suttas, a standard set of the negative mind states. And desires, basically raga, essentially, it is the things we're talking about before, the sense desires, desires that arise through the five senses. That is what that is about. And the hate here is just another word for all negative states of mind. Hate is not such a good translation because hate usually implies a very powerful emotion. But actually, any kind of negative mind state, you know, mild from mild annoyance to the most kind of strong rage, everything in between is included here. And the last one, delusion. Now that is a more difficult one because delusion, again, is very, very wide-ranging. In its deepest sense, delusion means the wrong understanding of the world around you in a very profound sense. And this has to do with enlightenment, with becoming awakened, about seeing the world in terms of a self, an I, rather than seeing it just as phenomena arising and passing away. But in this level of meditation, it doesn't normally mean that. In this level, delusion just means a mind state that is not clear. A confused mind state, a mind where you are maybe slothful, maybe restless, where you can't see things clearly. And I'm sure you know what that mind state is like. You have some idea of that mind state. You may not know the full range, but you have some idea what I'm referring to here. You may not have any anger, really. You may not have any strong desire, but still you feel confused and unclear. You're lacking clarity here. And that is delusion at this particular stage. And that is how you recognize that delusion here. So this is what happens when you then attend to a certain object in a certain way, these negative things arise. If that happens, then what should you do? And it says then what you should do is give attention to some other sign that is connected with the wholesome. And of course, the wholesome here are the opposites. That is the opposites of non-desire, renunciation, we were talking about before, about loving kindness and compassion, and about clarity of mind. The clarity of mind is opposite of delusion. So what you do here is you change the way, either the way you're looking at the object, or you change your object. Both of these are acceptable ways of changing the mind state from unwholesome to wholesome. And when you do that, then you abandon that particular negative mind states and the mind state subsides. Now, this is not an easy thing to do, to just change your attention from a negative mind state to a positive mind state. It is quite difficult. And one of the principles to be able to do this is to catch the negative mind state as early as possible. The more powerfully that negative mind state is lodged in your mind, and this again is from the suttas, the more difficult it is to remove. So ideally, you catch the mind state as soon as possible. And if you catch it very soon, before it has any momentum, before it has taken over the mind properly, then you are often able to turn the mind around and look in a different way. An example of how to do this is, for example, you imagine that very often these defilements arise in connection with people, both desire and ill will. Very often it relates to other human beings. Because human beings, somehow, they are the things that are closest to us, probably, are the humans. And because of that, they also affect us very powerfully, emotionally. So let's say that there is a person who makes you angry. You feel angry about this person. Or you can see that anger is just about to arise. You haven't really become very angry yet, but you can see that a trend is going that direction. Soon, you might get really upset. So what do you do? Well, what you do is that you remind yourself that this person is not just what you're seeing now. It could be somebody who you really love, who you're very close to, that who makes you upset for some reason. But if it is a good person and somebody who you actually respect, you turn your attention away from the negative things and you remind yourself of the positive things in that person instead. But to be able to do that, the only way you can really do that is by having practiced metta meditation before. In particularly, if you have done it to all beings, maybe even specifically to that person, because if you have a perception in your mind, it's like a store in your mind of perceptions, which you are a positive view of that person. If you have that store in your mind, you can bring that perception up when a problem is about to arise. And this is the importance of metta, not only meditation, but the way that we think about others, the way we conceive about others, the fact that you have built up this resistance inside of yourself, this a power of the storehouse of perceptions that you can bring up at will and change things around. And you will find that very often the things that irritate us in daily life are like small things. They are tiny little things, petty things, which don't really matter. If we did see the big picture, we would never get upset by these tiny little things. So by focusing, changing your attention and reminding yourself of the big picture, what this person really is like, the really good intentions and good qualities that are behind these tiny little things, it is not that hard to change your mind state around, just like that, from negativity arising to a positive mind state instead. So this is a big part of the Buddha's teaching, therefore, is actually to, in a sense, prepare yourself. Prepare yourself. You know that there are going to be times when you get upset. You know that there are going to be times when somebody is going to annoy you. So you have to have like this preparation, this foundation inside of you, which makes it possible for you to turn your mind over very fast if it is about to happen. So this is essentially how you can actually do change your mind from negative to positive very fast. It has to happen while the mind is still, the state is still about to arise. And it happens because of all the previous practice you have been doing. Otherwise, it is virtually impossible to do this kind of thing. If you haven't practiced, if you haven't prepared yourself, it is very, very hard. So that is the first one. And it is the same because anger and hate is the most important one. That's why I am emphasizing this. But it's the same with desire. With delusion, I must admit, I'm not even quite sure how you would do it with delusion. It is more difficult. But certainly with desire is the same thing. You remind yourself of the danger. You remind yourself of the alternative, sorry, not the danger, the alternative understanding of desire. You remind yourself of renunciation, the beauty of renunciation, and then you can turn your mind around from desire to renunciation very quickly. So this is the main thing here about how to overcome anger through changing from the unwholesome to the wholesome. And then if you do that, then it says that thought, that negative thought, is abandoned in him and it subsides. In other words, if you are successful, the abandoning happens almost straight away. This is wisdom power here. You're using your wisdom, you're using your accumulated practice of meditation, practice of contemplation previously. You're using that to change your mind over. That's why it's called wisdom power rather than willpower, as we mentioned before. And then, because that happens, with that abandoning, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness and concentrated. That is, it becomes unified. Now, this may sound very easy. All you have to do is to sort of swap the thinking around from unwholesome to wholesome, and then you gain this deep samadhi. Unfortunately, it is not quite that easy, because usually these thoughts go very deeply. Okay, we may catch the grosser of the thoughts, and we may be able to turn those around, but then there are more subtle thoughts, and they are also negative, they are also defilements. And because there are more subtle thoughts in the mind still doesn't become concentrated. So don't become discouraged just because you don't attain samadhi straight away as a result of this kind of practice. It takes often lots of practice, understanding the mind to deeper and deeper levels. And eventually you get to the level where the defilement is abandoned completely. And only then can you actually bring the mind to singleness. But what is so beautiful about this is that every time you have some success with the grosser of these thoughts, every time you can feel the beauty and the power of this kind of practice. You see the thought is abandoned, and then you feel much more peaceful afterwards. And then meditation usually goes much better than it did before. It may not be perfect yet, but still you find so much contentment, so much happiness, just from that one thing. So this is the thing about this path. Don't go looking for deep meditation straight away. Just look for an improvement in your mind state. See that an improvement is happening here. If an improvement is happening, you're going in the right direction. And if you keep going like that, eventually you will also get to the deep samadhis. But there's so much happiness and so much joy and so much goodness to be had on this path before you reach really, really deep samadhi. So enjoy every part of it, every bit of it as you go along. Don't just, if you have too much desire for deep meditation, you're just going to miss out on all the happiness and fun which happens before it. But eventually then, when you have abandoned everything, all of these negative mind states, then the mind does become steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness and concentrated. And then you have a simile here, just as a skilled carpenter or his apprentice might knock out, remove, or extract a coarse peg being the unwholesome thought, by means of a fine one, so the fine one being the wholesome thought. In this way, it is that you steady the mind internally, or you knock out one thought using a more refined one. So you can see here that even though you are knocking out the coarse thought, you are replacing the coarse peg with a fine peg. And of course, a peg is still a peg. So eventually you want to abandon the fine peg as well. But this is like a gradual process. One peg takes over from another one until the pegs disappear altogether. So that is the first one. And the reason why this method is mentioned first is because it is the most powerful one. It's the best one to use. If you can use this one, this is the one you should be using here. And one of the very important principles for reading the discourses of the Buddha, which I always like to mention to people, is that these discourses are always graduated. They have a certain sequence. Sequence here is not random. It happens according to a system. And this is true here as well. So the first method here is the most important one. And then comes the second method. If the first one doesn't work, comes the second one. And all the way up to the fifth method. So it's only when the first one doesn't work that you try the next one. But this is the best one and the most powerful one, because it changes your mind just like that. So then we come to method number two. If, while he is giving attention to some other object connected with what is wholesome, there will arise in him bad and wholesome thoughts connected with desire, connected with ill will, and connected with delusion, then he should examine the danger in those thoughts thus. These thoughts are unwholesome. They are blamable, or reprehensible, it says here, blamable, and they result in suffering. When he examines the danger in those thoughts, then any bad and wholesome thoughts connected with desire, with anger, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and unified. Just as a man or a woman, young, youthful, and fond of ornaments, would be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted if the carcass of a snake or a dog or a human being were hung around his or her neck, so too, and then the same thing for the unwholesome thoughts. When a bhikkhu examines the danger in those thoughts, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and unified. So what this is saying is that if the first method does not work and you don't have success straight away in bringing that unwholesome thought, taking it out, and by substitution and placing a wholesome thought in there instead, the next thing to do is to remind yourself of the danger of this thought. And you will remember this is exactly what we were doing yesterday. We're talking about the two kinds of thought. And remember the story of the Buddha. The Buddha thinks about, he classifies the thoughts into two categories, and he sets one category to one side, which are the unwholesome thoughts. And the way that the Buddha overcomes the unwholesome thoughts is precisely by remembering that they cause suffering. They cause suffering and they take away wisdom. So this method here is very similar to the method the Buddha was using before his own awakening experience. So remind yourself, where does anger lead you? Anger leads, if you're able to restrain yourself now, great, but often anger does lead to speech that is unwholesome, it leads to actions that are unwholesome, and even if it doesn't lead to that, it's still unpleasant. And in the long run, if you do act on that anger in a negative way, which you will do eventually, of course, it leads to bad karma as well. So it leads to suffering here and now, and it leads to suffering in future lives. It's quite clear. And you know that when you, as I also mentioned, as we also saw yesterday in the sutta, when you're angry, you don't really have any wisdom anymore. Wisdom ceases with anger. It ceases with these defilements because you cannot see clearly. Anger clouds your mind completely. You don't know what's happening, what's going on anymore. So for all these reasons, just remembering that, and again, this is something you have to work on, to develop, to be very, very clear that anger is a problem. And the more clearly you see that, the easier it is to actually dispel it when the situation requires you to do so. And again, the same thing is, of course, true with desire as well. We were talking about desire yesterday. Anger is really the one I want to focus on because it is the most important one. But also with desire to some extent. You know that if you have too much craving, eventually you're going to act on that craving in a bad way. You're going to do something stupid, do something you don't really want to do, and then cause suffering for yourself and others because of that. So remind yourself of the suffering in these things. And also what is very important, of course, from a Buddhist point of view, I was talking about this yesterday a little bit, that any anger that you have in this life, any craving you have in this life, you take it with you into a future life. And imagine that in this life, maybe you are a good person, you are somebody who's trying to practice a spiritual life, trying to do what is good, trying to purify yourself and reach meditation states and all these things. That may be true in this life. But who knows what's going to happen next time around? Who knows the kind of friends that will influence you in your next life? Who knows what's going to happen? Maybe Buddhism won't be around anymore. Maybe there won't be any good teachings that really appeal to you. And you start doing stupid things. Now, if the roots of anger, ill will, desire are still there, then they become very dangerous when you don't have something, some bigger picture to actually restrain yourself. So this is why, in a sense, these things are urgent and why they have to be done now. Because now is the opportunity. You just don't know when you have the opportunity again. So remember these things. These things really are dangerous. They do indeed lead to suffering, according to the Buddhist teachings. So when you reflect like this, and you make this thought powerful in your mind, again and again you reflect like that, then when the time comes when you actually need it, you just turn your attention to that danger. And if it works, it brings a stop to those thoughts again, just like that. They disappear. And the simile that is used here, a very powerful simile, it tells you something about the nature of this thinking and how bad it is. Just like a young person who is fond of ornaments would be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted at having a carcass of a snake and a dog or a human being hung around their neck. Not only, I think, a young person, I think anybody would be humiliated and disgusted and horrified with that. But that is how you should look at unwholesome thoughts. That is how strong it is. That is pretty strong. I know Ajahn Brahm, he goes even further. He said that any kind of thought you should have this idea towards. According to him, he reckons that any kind of thought is like a carcass of a snake. But certainly the unwholesome ones are that bad. So then, when you succeed in that, again, the mind becomes unified internally. So you are moving towards the adicitta, the deep states of samadhi. Then we come to the third method. And the third method, again, it is if the first one and the second one don't work, only then do you try the third method. And it goes as follows. If, while he is examining the danger in those thoughts, there still arise in him evil or bad, unwholesome thoughts, connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should try to forget those thoughts and should give no attention to them. When he tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with ill will, and delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and unified. Just as a man with good eyes who did not want to see forms that had come within range of sight would either shut his eyes or look away, so too, when a bhikkhu tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and unified, concentrated. So this is then the third way. So the third way here is either, it says here, forgetting the thought altogether, or you place, again, you just, it says here in the simile here, the simile says that you either shut your eye or you look away. So for example, if you are sitting in meditation, and let's say that you are watching the breath, and then some bad thought intrudes on your meditation subject, then instead of being carried away by the thought, you just place your attention gently back on the breath again. And when you place your attention gently back on the breath, then the thought just disappears into the background. Or if during daily life you have a bad thought, what you do is that instead of then buying into the thought during daily life, then whatever it is that you are doing, you place your attention back on what you're doing, and you allow the thought to subside into the background. So this is like forgetting about the thought, just putting your attention back onto what you are doing. Or if you are just enjoying the silence at this retreat center, and then some stupid thought intrudes, then just place your mind gently back on the silence again, on the beauty and the peace of this place. And just allow that thought to disappear in the background. So this is the forgetting of the thoughts. And again, when you do that, it is similar to just shutting your eyes not to see something here, or looking away not to see something here. You're placing your attention elsewhere here, and just forgetting about the thought. So this is then, remember that this is a sequence. So this is the third way, and this is not, becoming quite a long way down the scale here of importance. And the really important methods are the first two ones. Now it's getting more, this is becoming less and less important as we go down here. So then we have the method number four. And if, while he's trying to forget those thoughts and is not giving attention to them, there still arise in him bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with ill will, and with delusion, then he should give attention to the stilling, the thought formation of those thoughts. When he gives attention to stilling the thought volition or the thought activity, I think is a more meaningful translation. The thought volition, I think, is quite a good one. Stilling the thought volition of those thoughts, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with ill will, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and unified. Just as a man walking fast might consider, why am I walking fast? What if I walk slowly? And he would walk slowly. Then he might consider, why am I walking slowly? What if I stand? And he would stand. Then he might consider, why am I standing? What if I sit? And he would sit. Then he might consider, why am I sitting? What if I lie down? And he would lie down. By doing so, he would substitute for each grosser posture one that was subtler. So too, when a bhikkhu gives attention to the stilling of the thought volition of those thoughts, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and unified. So this method here is a little bit difficult to understand exactly what is going on, but to get a grasp of what's happening here, the word which here is translated as thought formation, this word is vitakka sankara in Pali. And sankara in Pali usually means the force of the will that is behind anything, the force of the will in the mind. And that's why I suggested volition as a translation. Volition is the will, right? So it is the will behind that thought, the thought will. In other words, the will that drives the thought. And the point here is that, if you are thinking, the reason you are thinking is because the thought is being driven by the will. Thinking doesn't just happen by itself. It might feel like all these thoughts just come into your mind. Thinking doesn't work like that. Thinking happens because you want to think. You are driving the thought. You intend to think. And it's the volition and the will of the mind that drives the thinking process. So you can imagine that if you withdraw the will, if you stop willing, or if you reduce the will, then the strength of that thought will subside as you withdraw the will from the thinking process. So the point of what is happening here, basically, it is this thing we sometimes is called like bare awareness. You're just watching, or it's called like non-judgmental awareness, or it's called there's many words for this kind of thing, where all you do is you're sitting back and you're watching what's happening, and you're not trying to will anything, to want anything that way or this way. And when you do that, when you just watch without involving yourself, without doing anything, without agitating the mind, then the mind starts to calm down. The thinking starts to calm down. And this is very much the kind of meditation I was teaching you before. All you do is watch. Bear awareness, be present, don't involve yourself, don't do anything. And when you do that, the mind starts to settle down. And this is the purpose of this simile that you see down here, the simile about walking fast, then walk slower. When you stand back and you start to watch, the mind starts to slow down. Instead of walking fast, the mind starts to walk slowly. the thinking goes more slowly here. Then when you increase that bare awareness, you are even less involved, and it's like standing here. Then when you stand and you withdraw the volition and the will even more, it's like sitting here. And then eventually you lie down. And lying down here is like the thinking stopping completely here. There's no thinking happening anymore in your mind. So it is that gradually allowing yourself just to be aware of what's happening without any kind of involvement. And you can see here, it's a gradual process. You learn this stage by stage to be less and less involved in what is going on inside your own mind. So this is basically the method of bare awareness, just watching and just allowing things to come to a stop. This can be quite difficult to do. It's not easy. But it's something that you, again, can learn over time, just watching what's happening, watching the content of your mind. Often, if you are already angry or you have some powerful fantasy or craving going on, then often you won't be able to do this because the anger will just override your ability to be aware, with bare awareness. So again, you have to try to catch it fairly early on. All of these methods really work only if you catch it fairly early. So you need a certain amount of mindfulness even to get started, in a sense. So mindfulness and unwholesome thoughts, they revolve around each other. You need mindfulness to be aware of the unwholesome thoughts, and then you abandon the unwholesome thoughts to get more mindfulness. And then this is why they work together. So the more you abandon, the greater the mindfulness, and the more you can abandon again. And it works upwards like that. So this is the bare awareness method. And when you use that, and when it succeeds, then again, the mind attains samadhi, singleness, quietness, steadied internally. Then comes the last method. And this method is sometimes a bit controversial, so I'll read it out for you. If while he is giving attention to stilling the thought volition or the will behind the thought of those thoughts, there still arise in him bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with ill will, and with delusion, then with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he should beat down constraint and crush mind with mind. Then, with his teeth clenched, his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind. Then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion are abandoned in him and subside. And with the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him and crush him, so too, with his teeth clenched and the tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, the bhikkhu beats down, constrains and crushes mind with mind. His mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness and concentrated. So this is the last method, and this is this is the only method which really talks about suppression of the thinking mind. So this is basically the thinking has gotten out of hand, and you decide to suppress it by power like this, by using the mind as forcing it down. You have to be very careful with this kind of method, and that's why it is last on this list. All the other methods are far more powerful, more important, and they are the ones that really work. This one here is very dangerous. And sometimes there's a tendency for people often to use the last method automatically. Because in daily life, sometimes if there's something that you don't like, very often we just suppress those thoughts. We sort of push them out of the way. So this is a method that we are, in a sense, used to using in ordinary life. Something comes up you don't like, you sort of push it out of the way. But in this path, this is the very last method. And usually, you should be able to avoid using this method at all because you use the other ones long before that. And of course, for people who come to meditation practice, sometimes people come who are maybe a little bit mentally unstable and maybe they've had problems with repression of thoughts in the past. You have to be very careful if you had that kind of problems in the past because this sort of thing can really make that much worse if you practice in this kind of way. So this, I would say that this method should really only be used if you really think that you know what you're doing. And there is actually another place in the suttas where the Buddha talks about his life before his enlightenment. And he says that one of the practices that he did in those days, and for those of you who know the story of the Buddha, you know that before his awakening, he would often practice this thing called the ascetic practices, where he would torture the body and torment himself. And one of the practices that he did was precisely the crushing mind with mind practice. This was one of the things that he did. And he says there in that sutta that this did not lead to awakening. It was a wrong kind of practice. So what that means is that this practice is good only insofar as it helps you in a kind of difficult, desperate situation where the mind doesn't want to cooperate. But it's not in itself enough. Usually you need more than this particular effort right here. This is just like a tool, a last resort tool in how to overcome the negative states of mind. So be careful with this one, because it is this type of willpower is often going to be detrimental to your meditation practice. Anyway, so those are the five methods of overcoming unwholesome thoughts. Keep those in mind. In particular, keep the first two in mind. The first two, I think, are very, very powerful, where you substitute and you have an unwholesome thought and you substitute it with a wholesome thought, or you remind yourself of the danger in those unwholesome thoughts. If you can use those two, they are very, very powerful and very useful in this particular practice. And then, eventually, you will move towards samadhi and quietness of the mind. So then, the Buddha goes on. Bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is giving attention to some object, and owing to that object there arises in him bad unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with ill will, and with delusion, then when he gives attention to some other object connected with what is wholesome, any such bad unwholesome thoughts are abandoned in him and subside. And with the abandoning of him of them, his mind is steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. When he examines the danger in those thoughts, when he tries to forget those thoughts and does not give them any attention, and when he gives attention to stilling the thought volition of those thoughts, and lastly, when he beats down and constrains those thoughts, the unwholesome thoughts are abandoned. His mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. This monk is then called a master of the courses of thought. He will think whatever thought he wishes to think, and he will not think any thought that he does not wish to think. And the last line here, he has severed craving, flung off the fetters, and with a complete penetration of conceit, he has made an end of suffering. That last line, I wouldn't pay too much attention to that one, because that last line is not found in the parallel to this discourse in the Chinese canon. And indeed, it seems a little bit out of place, because basically the sutta is about how to come to samadhi. It's not about how to attain the final destruction of the defilements and awakening. It's about how to attain samadhi. And it's very interesting that it doesn't occur in the Chinese, because what that means, I think, is that the Chinese is probably more likely to be correct again, because it doesn't fit the context very well. And if you look carefully at the wording in the Pali, you will see the wording even doesn't match very well. The tenses don't match very well. It looks like one sentence has been imported from somewhere else by accident, probably, and then it is a bit of a mismatch. So basically, the way this discourse ends is that he becomes a master of his thinking, and that fits very well with how the discourse has proceeded so far. Whatever thought you want to think, those you think. Whatever thoughts you don't want to think, you don't think them. Wouldn't that be wonderful to be able to do that? So then the last line of this sutta says, that is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Buddha's, the Blessed One's words. So this is the mastery of the thinking mind. Does anybody have any questions about this sutta? Danya.
And the first one, it sounds very similar to
Okay. Well, I think I think sense restraint is actually a little bit different, because ideally with sense restraint, you want to avoid the wholesome states to arise in the first place. So you're actually aware, you are aware that, you know, you're looking at something and you think, ooh, if I look at this a little bit longer, it's going to give rise to desire or anger or whatever. So you actually look away, or you look at the object in a different way to avoid that. The sense restraint is actually having enough mindfulness to be able to stop that anger and desire to rise in the first place. Now this here is more to overcome. Anger has already arisen. So that is the difference. So sense restraint is just like, you know, you see some food you really like, and you can see that desire or craving is about to rise, and then remind yourself, no, this is not the right time. This is the wrong time. It's not going to work. Forget about it and you move on, right? Whereas here, this is more like desire has arisen. Okay, what do I do now? But they overlap to some extent, because there's no absolute boundaries between these. I think there's some overlap there, and they certainly refer to the same thing here. Yes, sir. Yeah, I think that is the traditional explanation of this particular method number four here. It talks about actually understanding the origin of the thought, understanding where it comes from, and which is similar to the will, because the will is what drives the thought. So the will is really the origin of the thought, right? The willpower here. So you look at, why do you have the willpower in the first place? Where does the willpower come from? And then you can trace it back like that, and usually you can find a reason for that. But I think the main impetus, as I understand it, and I know that's the commentarial explanation, but I personally feel that the main impetus here is, the main reference here is actually to the will itself and calming the will down, which drives the thinking process. Yeah. Yes, Don. a thought which is neither hatred nor, it depends on what kind of thought it is. You mean like thinking about planning about the future or something like that? Yeah. Well, most thoughts are usually driven by desire or ill will. That's a very common thing. Or, as you say, delusion. But very often you will find there's some desire or maybe ill will involved in the thinking process. Maybe a very, very, very slight one, not very much. But very often, why do you plan for the future? Usually it is about some sort of desire you have about the future. You want to control it in a certain way. You want the outcome to be in a certain way. Well, why do you want the outcome to be in a certain way? Because you have a desire connected with that future. So very often there will be a subtle thought there, a subtle kind of defilement behind that. Possibly, I don't know, I guess there might be, there probably are certain thoughts which are not maybe related to desire or ill will at all. I'm trying to think. Well, thoughts about the Dhamma, for example. Well, that's often also related to desire. It depends on how you think about the past. If you recall your past lives, then it may not be connected with desire. But very often, thoughts of the past will be about desire. Usually. Unless there is something that you need to do. For example, you have lost something somewhere and you try to retrace the step to how to find that item, you need to find it, then maybe not so much connected with desire. There might be some exceptions, but very often I think it's connected with defilements. I think. It's very subtle. Kanchana, you want to? Yes, exactly. I think the first one is much more powerful, because in the first one you're really substituting an unwholesome thought and you're putting a wholesome thought there instead. So by doing that, you are actually holding back the unwholesome thought in a very powerful way. It's just like metta. I mean, you do metta and compassion. When you do that, it's like you put up a barrier against any negative thoughts that might arise, because that's already been planted in your mind, right? The barrier becomes very strong. But if you just forget something, it is a very, you know, a negative thought comes up and you just sort of push it, or you don't even push it aside, but you just focus back on your breath or whatever, it can very, very easily arise again. So the first method is much more powerful, because you are actively creating a wholesome state in the mind. Yes, you're not just avoiding it, avoiding the bad one. The last one is more like avoiding it. You forget about it. The first one is actually deliberately cultivating a wholesome state. But you're right, it takes a lot of mindfulness, and that's why it is difficult, and that's why these things have to grow together. You gradually overcome the negative, you become more mindful, and as you become more mindful, you become better at overcoming negative things. It is not easy to do, but eventually, gradually, you get there. Okay, everybody happy with that? Danya? Well, it's like, for example, you have a person, maybe somebody who you respect a lot, but still sometimes they irritate you. And then very quickly, you place the attention back on the good qualities in that person, that you know you are there. You have cultivated looking at those good qualities for a long time. So instead of looking at the negative, the tiny little negative thing which arises in the moment, you quickly place, you remind yourself of the good qualities of this person. The virtue, the kindness, the wisdom, whatever. And then you can quickly put an end to those negative thoughts. No, I think it's more active. It's more active than that. It's not just enjoying this present moment. It's actually about in meditation. I mean, this is the kind of thing you would use, like, for example, you sit in meditation and then a negative, an angry thought about somebody rises while you're meditating. Quickly, you remind yourself of the good qualities in that person. So you give rise to the opposite thought. You give rise to metta instead of anger. Right? Not anger, but say annoyance, a slight negativity. Anger is often too late already, but a slight annoyance towards somebody. You place your attention back on the positive qualities of that person, and you give rise to metta or compassion instead. That's what it means. So you focus, you change your focus from something which is negative to something positive. Or you can change the object completely. If that is a person you may find it difficult to have any good thoughts towards a particular person, you look at another person instead, and you change to somebody who you know that you have some good thoughts about instead. You place your attention on them, give rise to a wholesome state of mind, and then it's very unlikely that the other person, that memory, will give rise to the same thing later on. So it's either a different aspect of the same object or a different object altogether. Whatever gives rise to something wholesome in your mind. Right? Yeah? Okay. Yes? Is there? I'm sure there is. Yeah. Oh, yes, that's true. Yeah, I think I was doing the rains retreat last year or something like that. That's true. I remember that now. Yeah. It was a sutta about if, for example, somebody has bad speech habits, you remind yourself of the good bodily actions. If they have bad bodily actions, you remember some of the good speech habits. If they have some kind of, as you say, even a speck of goodness inside of them, but they do many stupid things, you remember the good speck. So it's about the ability to focus narrowly on just certain aspects of a person. And by doing that and forgetting the rest, you can give rise to good states of mind. Yeah. That's true. That was a situation. Yeah, I remember that one now. Yeah. Okay. It's almost 4 o'clock already. Is there any more questions before we? I was thinking of going on to the next sutta, but I think it's getting too late already. Anybody have anything else about this they want to bring up? It all makes sense so far. So the next sutta is also along the same lines. It's about this one here. It grades defilements into different grades. And this is also quite interesting. So I won't get into that now, because then we're just getting ahead of ourselves. So, Okay, so nothing else? Okay, good. So then I will see you again at about 7:30 this evening. So just keep enjoying yourself. Have a good time. Don't get too... Sometimes you read the sutras, you think, yeah, I've got to get in there, and you put too much willpower into it, and you feel really miserable afterwards. So don't push too hard just because you've been reading this inspiring sutras. Just enjoy yourself, have a good time, and see how things go. And I'll see you this evening. Let's pay our respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.